Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 1st of October. General Wesley Clark is with us this hour. He has a new book about his extraordinary life, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. He says in the intro to the book that the United States right now finds itself at a difficult juncture as the most powerful country in the world, embroiled in two simultaneous wars, subjected to a terrorist threat, ever more deeply engaged in a dynamic global economy that will challenge America's economic preeminence, our long-term prosperity, and our own character and values. He says he has been appalled by the ineffective ways in which the Bush administration has been handling the problem of Iraq and the regional threat posed by Iran, and he has a plan to help us recover the legitimacy that America has lost in that part of the world. He grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas during the 1950s, pre-civil rights time, pre-Vietnam War time. He went to college at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, two more years at Oxford University, and then he went to Vietnam where he was infantry company commander in combat and was wounded in Vietnam. He held subsequently 23 different jobs, spent 5 years in various schools, taught college-level economics and political philosophy, served as a special assistant to a member of Ford's cabinet, filled various Army staff roles, and ended his military career as the supreme Allied commander in Europe. He, of course, ran for president and was drafted to run in 2003. We have a lot to talk about with him. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. If you want to send us an email, do that. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org for you to join our conversation. General Clark, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and thanks for that kind introduction.
Yeah, you're entirely welcome. Let's start with your mom. Your mom had a tough task. Your dad died at the age of 51, left a diamond ring, an old car, and that was about it, and your mom stepped in.
It was a really tough time for my mother. I have no doubt about it. She was in Chicago, and my father's family was Jewish. He didn't actually practice, but of course they had all the family traditions, the Friday night dinners and so forth. And he'd married my mother. He was the oldest of seven. He was the last to get married. The joke, one of my cousins told me that the joke was that when he was 40, his mother called him in and said, "Ben, you're the last one. Just marry anyone." So he married my mother. His mother knew he was dating my mother, and she wasn't of the faith, and so there was a problem. Mm. And then he was in public service, and he just wasn't interested in money. He was outgoing and gregarious, and he was a real smart lawyer. He graduated the top of the class in his law school. And so when he died unexpectedly, as happens with heart disease, just at 51, he was dead.
Yeah.
And I was 3 years old, and it was devastating on my mother. There was no resources there to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, some of the family would have helped out, but she didn't want that. She felt like it wasn't right, and she took us back to Arkansas, and we moved in with her parents, and she got a job as a secretary in a bank. She lied about her age. She was afraid at the age of 42, 43 that they wouldn't hire her.
So my gosh.
So she lied a little bit about her age.
Yeah.
But it's the way it was.
And it was hard for you. You write early in the book about how you were hanging with the neighborhood kids and had a lot of friends, et cetera, but that you really sorely missed the presence of a father.
Everybody had a father. This was, you know, Doris Day America.
Right.
Everybody's father had fought in the Second World War. There were young families. They were upwardly mobile. The idea was to move every 5 years and get a new house and a bigger house. And there was my mother. She was a working mom. She was the only working mom on the block. And it was my grandmother and granddad that took care of me for the first couple of years. There was no preschool. There was no kindergarten. And it was really, it made you feel funny. I mean, it was like, you know, kids would say, "Well, my dad does such and such. What about your dad?" And it was a kind of thing that you just, I mean, it was different. I don't think it's quite the same today. Maybe it is in some neighborhoods, but it was, ev- everybody had a father.
Yeah. It was striking to me, General Clark, to read, because it wasn't that long ago, how different it was in many other areas as well. Segregation still very prominent. The whole issue of race, even in your family, how your stepfather felt about this issue. This was not very long ago, and people had very different views.
Well, it's a huge issue.
Yep.
Today. It still hasn't been resolved satisfactorily in American life. And I was present at the beginning of what you might call white rage, because it was the anger at whites in the South of having conditions forced on them they viewed from the outside. When the 101st Airborne came into Little Rock, Arkansas, and Life magazine followed, and, you know, we just celebrated the 50th anniversary down at Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
People were confused, but most people felt that it was that we were a good city and somehow we weren't appreciated. And so that became the seed corn of Richard Nixon's Southern strategy.
Right.
We're good people, but these outsiders, they don't understand us for who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, 30 years, 40 years later, I was in the Balkans and listening to the Serbs talk about how Serbs had always been oppressed and no one ever appreciated the Serbs. I think to myself, I've heard this same song.
Oh my.
This is exactly the same tune of the American South
mm-hmm.
in the era of desegregation.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to sort right from wrong and you've got to move forward.
Yeah.
We say in this country that every person is created equal. By God, we say that they're equal under the law. They should be treated with equal respect, regardless of any discriminator. And that's the way we did it in the United States Armed Forces. That's what I believe in. And I think if we could help others around the world see this, and this is a very hard thing for people to accept, as I learned growing up in the South,
mm-hmm.
we could do so much for mankind.
Yeah. As a result of the Little Rock experience, you faced a time when you didn't really have a high school to go to, right? You had to look at going away to an academy until there would be a public school that would open again.
Well, this is exactly right. What happened is that the first year, when all the fighting took place and the 101st was there, the kids went to high school. I was in the eighth grade that year, and the ninth grade was, at that time, part of junior high. The next year is when the schools were closed. So I had the ninth grade and junior high. The high schools were closed, and parents had to figure out what to do with their kids.
Goodness.
Because there was no assurance that the schools were going to open the next year either. It so happened that they did. But by that time, I was already committed to go away to school for a year, which
mm-hmm.
I did.
Mm-hmm. But then you came back.
I came back because I had this crazy idea that, you know, part of being a good American was to help the United States win the technology battle with the Soviet Union. It was about Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do my part by learning calculus.
And
I would go over and read these books at the medical center on Russian and on higher mathematics and try to get ahead of the class.
Oh, my gosh.
And when I found out that I could take calculus in the Little Rock Public Schools, in the 12th grade, it took away any requirement to have to go to private school.
Really? I didn't know you were such a swimmer. You're a big-time swimmer.
Well, I always liked sports, but I wanted to be part of a team.
Yeah.
And I would always, my stepfather was a really great athlete, and he would come out, and I would always pester him, and I'd say, Dad, come out and play basketball. Play football with me. So he set up the hoop in the backyard on the garage, and we would dribble out there and play horse and stuff. And he'd show me how to dribble. He'd say, Kid, you got to dribble low. You got to be able to do it with either hand. And for whatever reason, maybe he was just impatient with me, or maybe I really had no ability. But one day he said, Kid, you're never going to be a great basketball player. He said, and my stepfather wasn't a big man. He was like 5'9", but he could do a running dunk. And he said, I've got arms like a gorilla. I've got hands like meat hooks, and he could palm a basketball, and he could do a running dunk and stuff that at 50. That, of course, I mean, I couldn't do it when I was 50. But he said, you're never going to be a basketball player. Go find another sport. And I went into swimming, and I loved it.
What did you do, though? Tell the story of what you did when you were 50. You jumped off this. That's a great story.
It was a strange afternoon. We had just gotten started with our trip in the Balkans with Richard Holbrook, and we had Joe Kruzel there and Bob Brazier and several others were sitting around trying to, with Peter Galbraith, we were trying to organize ourselves, and we were at a little resort on the Dalmatian coast in a town, little suburb called Marina, and we were staying at the Tower Motel, and it was a it was built right on the water, and it was run by some German-speaking Yugoslavs who said, who told one of the people in our group, said, well, sometimes people get drunk and they jump off the third-floor balcony into the water. And we looked at it. It was hot. It was like 95 degrees. Mm-hmm. We were sweating and we were tired. It was about 6 o'clock at night. And Joe Kruzel was an Air Force Academy graduate. I was a West Point graduate. And we thought, let's get everybody up there, sort of a bonding experience. Let's have them all jump off. And it was about maybe 35 or 40 feet, maybe not that high, I don't know. But it didn't look that high when you were looking up at it.
Looking down at it.
It came down to the the two of us got up there, and we looked at it. I stepped over the railing and stood there, and I looked. I said, this is pretty high. And then I went off, and then Joe went off, and we swam across that little harbor, and it was beautiful blue-green water, warm, and we thought, we were both 50 years old.
And you were 50.
This is not bad for 50.
It is not. Well, tell me about this attraction for the military. You really desperately wanted to go to West Point, and you worked very hard to get into that school. Why was it so attractive to you? Why did you want to go there and nowhere else, really?
Great education. And a great opportunity for public service. I've been a camp counselor at the Little Rock Boys Club summer camp at the Joseph Pfeiffer Kiwanis Boys Camp, and I'd learned leadership there, and I'd also tried working as an assistant to a stockbroker in Little Rock. I was a chart boy. I had to read Barron's Financial Weekly, and I had to use a number 3 pencil. I had to mark down the for about 100 stocks the range of the stock and put a tick at the close of the stock. And I just couldn't, stand it. The thought of working in an office just by myself, I just couldn't do it. I thought, I want leadership. And when the opportunity came and I realized what West Point really had to offer, there was just no other choice for me. I said, I'm going there. I told my friends in high school in a calculus class, I said, this is it, West Point. It's going to be like MIT in the sciences and math. It's going to be like Harvard in the social sciences. It's leadership. It's a life of action. It's what I want.
Mm-hmm. You start the book with a near-death experience in Vietnam, which is quite dramatic in terms of, you know, some of the people who didn't want to be there who were fighting with you, and quite dramatic in that you almost lost your life there, General Clark. And I wonder how do you take that in your life? How do you take that near-death experience? You didn't die, obviously, but you came so close. What do you do with that? How do you absorb it?
Yeah, it's confusing.
Mm.
It's like a lot of it's one of those go no go moments in life that you really have no choice about. It just sort of happened. And had I not turned just as the enemy soldier pulled the trigger on the AK-47, I would have been hit by 3 rounds right up the center of my body. But turning, he hit me on the side, and I survived.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of different emotions for a long time. I was, when it happens, after you escape from it, you feel a sort of exhilaration,
mm-hmm.
as though, you know, death came calling for you and you've escaped. And then after that, you get a wave of fear that comes through you and you say, oh my God, I mean, I almost died.
Right, right.
And then, you know, it's replaced by anger. And the anger lasted, in my case, for several years. In 1979, 9 years after I was shot, I was shaving. I always would think about the 19th of February because that was the day I got shot. It was the 19th of February. I was working for General Haig in Europe. I was a major about to be a lieutenant colonel in the Army. I had long since recovered from my wounds, and I'm putting shaving cream on my face and looking at my face, and I'm thinking to myself, I screwed up. I should have killed that guy. I'm really mad. And it's the first time I realized how angry I was at myself for not having killed the man who shot me. It took me a long time to admit that I had had a sense of failure personally for having not killed the man who killed me or tried to kill me. And I finally let it go. That's how long it takes.
Yeah.
I think it takes a long time to get through these experiences, to that are associated with death and near death.
Right. And what about all of those now who are serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, also wars that were, as you well know, that are controversial wars? Is it harder when you come home from those if you're wounded? Is it more likely you'll be mentally wounded? Are we doing enough to help those soldiers?
Well, the answer is it's likely that you'll have mental wounds that you don't know anything about, that you don't appreciate. Being away from home for a year or 15 months, it changes the family dynamics, even if you did nothing but be on a business trip. But when you're in combat and you're facing danger, and both you and your spouse at home are worried about the danger, and you're facing it directly, she or he at home is facing it indirectly, and then especially if you've killed other people,
yeah,
and you've seen slaughter on the battlefield, and you've smelled it, and you've had good friends killed, and so forth. It could be devastating emotionally. I was giving a speech in New Hampshire a couple of years ago, and a woman came to me and she said, "Well," she said, my father would have loved to have heard your speech. He was in Vietnam. He was a helicopter door gunner." I said, "Well, where is he? What's happened to him?" She says, "Oh, he died in 1985." I said, "Well, what did he die from?" She said, "Well, he died from post-traumatic stress disease.
Yeah.
And I said, "How did he die from that?" She said, when he came back from Vietnam in 1970, he'd seen a lot of action. He'd fired a lot. He'd seen some people killed. He'd been shot down once in a helicopter. He was okay, but then over time, he just lost his ability to function. And she said, at the end, he just sat on his couch in the living room, watched television, and shook most of the day.
Mm.
And it was so sad.
Mm.
And I'm really worried about our young people who've been there, who've had to use their weapons and killed other people and so forth, because it has a tremendous impact on people.
We'll take phone calls for General Clark in a moment. Wesley Clark is our guest. His book has just been released, the story of his extraordinary life in terms of where he grew up, single mom, Little Rock, Arkansas, issues of race in this book, and, of course, all the work that he has done in Vietnam, the work he did as the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, and his run for the presidency. He has a lot to say about what we're doing in Iraq and what we're doing in Afghanistan, and how come we have lost our legitimacy in that part of the world, and how to restore it, and on it goes. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. One line is open if you'd like to get it. His book is A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wesley Clark is our guest. His book is A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. And we start our calls with Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. I was looking at, based on the record that you had in Europe, and especially with your handling of the Balkans and their refugee crisis during the war and after, if you could be put in charge of the refugee problem, internal and external, in the Middle East right now, what are the two or three things that you would do right away to alleviate the pain and suffering that the Iraqi people are going through right now?
Well, if you term it as refugees, then it means you've got to provide security and placement for millions of people who've come out. A couple of million people is the low ball estimate. It may be as high as 4 million people. They're in Syria. They're in Jordan. These countries have to have reception facilities. They've got to have money for education and health care. They're going crazy on all of this, and so we just need to do a lot for them. I think it's a matter of money and organization and leadership.
This would be an appropriate time before we go to an email that came in. You say in the book that you worry that America has lost much of its legitimacy in the Middle East and that you have a plan to help us recover it. What is that plan, General Clark?
Well, I think you have to start by recognizing what we've done wrong. And that means saying that we're not going to have any permanent bases in Iraq. We're not there to conquer a country. We're not there to occupy a country permanently. We're just there to help. And then I think you have to follow through and assure that we treat people the right way all the way through. And that means standing firm on American values of the rule of law, on civil rights, of human rights. We have to take care that we don't compromise our principles in the pursuit of enhanced security.
We have an email coming in, Andy from Door County, Wisconsin, who says, General Clark, first, thank you for your service. My question is, why do you think over the last 8 years the Republican Party has been able to harshly attack war heroes and veterans such as you, John Kerry, Max Cleland, and even John McCain, yet still be able to claim that they are pro-military and support the troops, even while they've been trying to cut military funding and benefits?
It's a real mystery to me. I think it's because, for whatever reason, the media tends to defer to the right wing on matters of national security. I think the Democratic Party, really starting with Vietnam, sort of ceded the playing field to the right wing.
Thanks for the call, Paul. Let's go to Milton from West Allis. Hi.
Hi. As a person who's had to deal with some nuclear issues, I know it can be profoundly affecting. Could you speak for just a minute or so on how having to deal with nuclear weapons issues affected you both as a military person and a civilian? And could you comment on the most recent incident we had of nuclear weapons supposedly being mistakenly moved?
Well, I think that all of us that grew up and were children during the 1950s remember the duck and cover drills and the emphasis on civil defense in America. There was a sense of an imminent threat there. It was, I mean, the movie Red Dawn was made in the 1980s, but the feeling of Red Dawn, that you might have to defend your country, that was a 1950s feeling. That's the way we felt. And we couldn't quite imagine what nuclear warfare would be like, but we knew it would be awful. And we had nuclear weapons to deter an attack. The idea was, like the motto of the Strategic Air Command, peace is our profession. If we ever have to be used, it means we will have failed. The idea was deterrence, and that is still the fundamental idea behind nuclear weapons. Although the United States has never said we wouldn't use nuclear weapons first, we've always said that our strategy is deterrence. And it's that deterrence strategy which I think was responsible for maintaining peace between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War and providing the degree of stability that we had. It could have gotten a lot worse. I think nuclear weapons served a deterrent purpose. But we also recognize that if we didn't control the spread of nuclear weapons, eventually they'd be used, they were horrible, and they could destroy mankind. So we entered onto the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in the late 1960s. We agreed as Americans that eventually we'd get rid of our nuclear weapons. We encouraged other nations not to develop them. And now suddenly all this is at risk. When I was in the Clinton administration, we looked at our nuclear policy at the beginning of the post-Cold War period. We said, yes, for a while we're going to need a nuclear deterrent. It's not aimed at anybody in particular, but it's still an uncertain world out there, so we kept it. But we also emphasized that we wanted to move toward a comprehensive test ban treaty, and we didn't want to be testing nuclear weapons, and the idea was to kind of make it impossible for other nations to modernize their weapons and continue to develop new weapons. Well, we failed, and this administration came to office and immediately began to talk about a new nuclear weapon, and I guess that means they want to test it. They certainly haven't moved ahead with a comprehensive test ban treaty. And now there's this report of this nuclear weapon that was somehow inadvertently left, four of them actually, left under the wings of aircraft and flown around the United States. I think it was inadvertent. I don't think that was anybody's signal, but I think it's a sign of an apparent laxness in standards that we never had during the Cold War. Yeah. It has to be tightened up right away.
Sure does. Don't want that happening. Don't want those things flying around. Thanks very much for the call. Another email from John in Milwaukee. When and how did you decide to join the Democratic Party? Did you ever speak with Colin Powell about how he made the same decision but in the other direction?
I never talked to Colin Powell about this. directly. He told me that those were his friends, and he just stayed with the people who were his friends. Most of the people in the military were friends with Republicans, not with Democrats, because the Democrats, after the Vietnam War, had a reputation for being anti-military. They just didn't respect people in uniform. It wasn't, I mean, you could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, especially a lawyer, but you couldn't be a military professional. It was as though, you know, you're down there with some other non accredited profession. But the Republicans made a big deal about patriotism, and they made a big deal about the military. Ronald Reagan, for example, with restoring the defense budget. And so it was a natural kind of thing for Colin Powell to stay that way. For me, when I went into the high positions in the Pentagon in the early 1990s, I didn't know what to expect, but I found in the Clinton administration that they were actually much more open, much more effective in dealing with all of the elements of national power than what I'd seen in the Ford administration in the 1970s, and I began to revise my opinion of Democrats. But I wasn't a member of a party until the summer of 2003. Finally, I agreed to become a Democrat. But it was a tough decision for me because I'd been pursued by Republicans in Arkansas who wanted me to run as a Republican. One guy even called me and said, hey, you'll never make it in elective office unless you're a Republican. That made me really upset because it was hard for me to believe that people would use national security for partisan purposes. That's how naive I was, I guess you could say,
yes.
6 years ago, because yeah. It's been nothing but using national security right. for political purposes ever since.
You recount this interesting phone call and conversation you had, and I want you to give us a few more details. When you called in August of 2000, Condoleezza Rice, who was then assisting Texas Governor George Bush in his presidential campaign, saying, I'd like to talk to you, she said, and she came over to your office in Washington, and you have what you describe as a brittle conversation with her.
It was so strange. I mean, she walked in, and I thought she was going to be a friend of Colin Powell's, and I like General Powell. I worked for him at Fort Carson in the 1980s. I saw him after I retired. He gave me some advice on how to, you know, move into the business community and other things and about writing my first book, and I've always admired General Powell, and I thought she was on, you know, like him. And when she came in and she sat down with me, I mean, immediately the conversation turned confrontational and sour. It was like, I'd like to just share some thoughts I was over in NATO. She says, yes, I know that. And I said, the work's not finished over there. Well, it's work we shouldn't have been doing.
Oh my.
We didn't have any business being in the Balkans, and you people screwed up our relations with Russia, and our troops don't have any business in Europe. And every premise that I had built an understanding of foreign policy on, going back to my work for General Alexander Haig, a notable Republican, in the late 1970s, and all of the thinking about American strategy, she was invalidating. It was like, give up on Europe, pull our troops out, we're not interested in them, let's go get in a war with Saddam Hussein. And she didn't say that. She said, we got to move our troops to where they're going to fight. I mean, she just didn't have any appreciation for what we've been going through in the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. So it would have been impossible for me to agree with that. Just like it would be impossible for a man like Dave Petraeus to say, hey, we have no interest in Iraq, let's just leave.
Right.
When you're over there and you're working it and you see how it all fits together, you end up believing in it. And I believed in what we did during the 1990s. I think we served a very important function in Europe, and I was prepared to stand on that. And so the conversation ended with total disagreement between the two of us.
It certainly did. It was a very interesting meeting. Let's go to Will from Windsor next. Hi, Will.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the program. Hi, General.
Hi, Will.
I can relate to your experience, the same similar experience I had during my first tour in 1966 when I was serving with the Wolfhounds. My question to you, though, is what is your take on what the military is doing now in lowering the standards to get personnel in? And I'm speaking of people from gangs and other people that have felonious records that are being accepted. That's one question. The other one is, what's your take on recruiters having rampant access in the schools and not really giving the young people, the students, the truth about the bonuses, about stop loss or any of this. And I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks, Will.
Well, Will, I can kind of see where you're coming from. First of all, I believe that we're whether we want a volunteer army or not, that's what we're stuck with. We're not, in the middle of the war, going to go to a draft unless the army itself collapsed or unless the enemy's coming over the borders. And as long as that's the case, we have to try to make the volunteer army work. I do think that we've gone a long, long way in trying to address a lot of the personnel issues that you and I learned to live with during the 1960s. It pays a lot better. Health care is good. We're trying to take care of families. We give people extraordinary re-enlistment bonuses now and enlistment bonuses. So they're getting a whole lot more money than they've ever gotten before. Can it go further than that? I don't know. And I don't know how we're going to raise the extra 100,000 troops we need while we're in the middle of war. But we do need those troops, and I hope we'll get them. With respect to the actions of the recruiters, I think that, of course, this is the way the system works. You put a lot of pressure on these recruiters. You say, get out there, here's your quota, here's the number of people you got to bring in. Look, if they don't recruit, you won't have an army. I mean, it's that simple. And so I do think that every college in America and every high school should welcome military recruiters. I think they should be held to a high standard. I think if you welcomed them and held them to a high standard, you might prevent some of the abuses that I've read about. There are some people who've abused this system. I know there's some people out there who haven't quite told the truth about some of these aspects of service life. They should, but the way to do it is open access and then enforcement of high standards, not shutting them out, because that only leads to a conscription process and a failed military. America needs a good army.
And thanks for the call. Let's talk a little bit about the decision to run for the presidency. You get this telephone call. It's not something that you've really thought about very deeply, but somebody suggests it to you, and all of a sudden, there you are, and you got to make a decision about whether or not you're going to do it. Why did you do it? It's a big thing to do.
Well, because ultimately, if one person comes to you and says, you should run for president, that's flattery.
Right.
When 70,000 are online saying you should run, and party leaders call you, then you realize there's an opening there and there's a requirement. And if you really believe in public service, it's pretty hard to say at that point, well, gee, I believe in public service, but this isn't for me. The thing is, I've been out on book tours. I've been out speaking. I've been on television. I'd led the United States and 18 other countries in a successful military campaign in the Balkans. Really 3 years of peace and war combined in a sort of political military struggle against Slobodan Milosevic. I'd done all that, and I went to see President Carter, and he said, you're as qualified as anybody else. You should run. And so ultimately I did. Joe Biden told me, he says, you've got a 30% chance of getting the Democratic nomination. I thought, well, it would have made me feel better if he said, you've got a 70% chance. But he didn't say that. But think of it. Somebody says, you've got a 30% chance of being able to do all this good for all these people, all the things that I believe in, that I wanted to work for. I couldn't say no. Education, health care, a better business environment, technology, addressing the kinds of needs that America has for its infrastructure, working the armed forces, as well as getting us out of Iraq the right way. I couldn't say no to that.
Let's go to Laura from Kenosha. Hi, Laura.
Yeah, hi, General Clark. This is a thrill to speak to you. A few years before you ran for president, I was listening to your views on a TV talk show on Sunday morning. And when I heard the way you spoke and what you said, I vowed that I would support you if you ever ran for president. So I remembered your name, and when you did, it was like a miracle. I was so thrilled.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you.
Well, no, this is the truth from my heart. But and I couldn't understand why everyone else didn't see why you were the most qualified. I mean, your background in foreign policy, your background in economics, your military service. I was just wondering, what do you think could have been done better?
Well, for one thing, you have to have, running for office for the presidency, it's about two things. It's about celebrity and brand image. And the fact that you gave me, you know, you remembered me and supported me, that tells me I had the celebrity status I needed. But the brand image had to be worked on. People have to really know who you are. And people didn't really know who I was. It wasn't an indestructible brand image. You also have to have a staff. I had no staff. And you have to have people on that staff who know you and can represent you and work on your behalf. I didn't have anybody. So the result was that in the transition, it took too long to get the campaign up and running. We made a fatal mistake in not being in Iowa. Had we been in Iowa, I might very well have won Iowa, and I'd have been off to the races, and that would have been the end of it.
Hmm.
But not winning Iowa changed everything.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you for your support, Lauren, for that great call.
And you have endorsed Senator Hillary Clinton this go-around,
haven't
you?
Yes, I have.
For what reason?
Well, I think she's very well qualified. I think she's the best qualified person in the race.
Mm-hmm.
She's got tremendous experience. She has given her life to public service. She started in high school with elective office. She knows how to get elected, but she's been in office. As a senator, she's proved herself. She was there in the White House in some really tough conditions. You know, she made her first trip to the Balkans in 1995. She was there in Kosovo right after the war ended in 1999. She's seen it. And there's just no substitute for experience. She's smart. She does her homework. She has an incredible energy level. And she's got great character. She's really resolute. She's got strong principles. I think she's got everything it takes to be a great president and a great commander-in-chief.
More phone calls for General Clark in just one moment. We're speaking with Wesley Clark this hour. His new book has just been released, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. And our phone number is 1-800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, and a couple of you have done that, that's good. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now. And let's go to Boyd from Milwaukee next. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, General Clark.
Good morning.
Thank you for your service. My question is this, and I want to phrase this correctly. Senator Feingold had proposed that after the current administration leaves office, I want to say that a censor or something be put in place. But he argued, you know, we as Americans need to learn from these mistakes. And if we don't, it will come back. And I believe especially what's going on in Iraq, is not as bad as Vietnam. I think it's worse. And if there's going to be a war after this, it could even be worse than Iraq. Your thoughts?
Well, I do think that we have to learn from our experiences, and clearly there's a lot of learning to be done on this. Look, we knew better than to go into Iraq in the first place. You don't go to war unless there's no alternative. And we knew how to think about what happens after we get to Baghdad. We had done the same thing in Kosovo. We'd done this in Haiti. We'd done it in Bosnia. It's just that this administration didn't want to listen. This is not about learning. This is about the American people. When the leaders let people down, the American people have to hold the leadership accountable. I ran for office in 2003 because I thought the American people should hold the president accountable for misleading us into Iraq. I still believe that's the case. This Republican Party has misled the American people. It should be thrown out of office, lock, stock, and barrel.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Boyd, for the call. You became an analyst, I believe, on CNN. You were on a lot following September 11. Tell me what you knew about al-Qaeda. What did you know about bin Laden? I believe that you thought right away that it was the work of al-Qaeda, September 11.
Absolutely. 11th. We knew about him from the military. This was the group that had attacked our embassies in Africa in 1998. And starting really with the attack on Khobar Towers in 1996, in the United States military, we'd gotten very, very interested and very tough on counterterrorism and anti-terrorism. And so we'd done a lot of homework on al-Qaeda. I'd read the information on him. I knew who he was, what his motives were, what his background was, and what his plans were in general, and what he was trying to do. So I knew from the outset that this was the work of al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. And you also knew that the administration, just from all the people that you know in the military and in politics, that the administration was deciding to attack Iraq.
Yeah. It was, first of all, when the administration came to office, they didn't want to listen to our experience about al-Qaeda. So the real crime in this was that in the first 7 months, 8 months of the Bush administration, when the warning began to build up that al-Qaeda was getting ready to strike, this administration went on vacation. Hmm. When the president could have called the cabinet together and worked to fix the problem, he was in Texas. Mm-hmm. We still don't know if he ever read the presidential daily brief of, I think it was the 8th of August of 2001, in which it's titled, Al-Qaeda Determined to Strike the United States. Maybe he didn't even read it. We don't know. The whole issue surrounding the Bush administration's failure to take action to prevent that terrible tragedy with the World Trade buildings and the Pentagon, that issue has never been adequately addressed. There were people who simply were negligent in their duties, and that needs to be, they need to be held accountable for that. And then in the aftermath, to take us into Iraq, that was the height of your responsibility. I went through the Pentagon and a week after 9/11, and one of the 3 stars told me, sir, we're going to war with Iraq. And I said, why? Why are we doing this? He said, there's no good reason.
Hmm.
And that's pretty distressing. That's from that moment on, I began, that's when I really started to question the direction of the administration.
Let's go to Lear from Madison, our next caller. Hi, Lear.
Good morning, General Clark. My name is Lear, and I'm from Albania.
Lear, nice to talk to you.
First, it's a real pleasure and honor, and I met you when you came in Madison. And first, I really just want to thank you for what you have done for the Albanian people in Kosovo.
Thank you.
And to end the genocide there. I will never forget, and we will never forget.
Thank you.
That aside, I want to wish you good luck with everything, also with the book that you wrote. And I wanted to ask you, do you think Kosovo will have its independence this year, considering the United States is kind of the only one still pressing for that?
President Bush has pledged it will have its independence. So I hope he'll follow through on his pledge. I think it's very important. If I had any influence over it, we would follow through on this pledge. There's nothing to be gained by further delay past the end of this year.
Thank you very much, sir. Best of luck with everything.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We go to Steele next from Nina. Hi, Steele.
Yes, good morning. I served as an Army brat, and I was wondering what your thoughts are of Marine General Carl Munday's comment in 93 to take only single recruits. And just one thing, in 71, the Army rank of E5, 14% married, and in 1986, 73% were married. And in a way, Hawaii was talking, you know, in the early days, World War II, how few soldiers were married, and the high cost of supporting families.
Well, there's no doubt about it, and it changes the Army to have people who are young married soldiers. But I don't think you can turn back the clock on this. I think the truth is that young soldiers are going to get married. You get a lot of fine people in the armed forces because they get married early, they have families early, and they're looking for the kind of stable lifestyle that the armed forces in peacetime can provide. They're looking for family benefits and health care and other things that a lot of jobs in America don't provide today. So that's a major recruiting major recruiting inducement for the volunteer force, and that's why the Army has changed its character. I don't think you can turn the clock back. I recognize the difficulties, but I love those young families. They're wonderful people.
Let's spend a little bit of time talking about your family, because you were in Vietnam when your son was born. I'm sure that it was not hard, that it was not easy for your wife, Gert, for your son, for you, to live the kind of life that you have led. You have had to have been away a lot, haven't you?
Well, there's a lot of stress in the home.
Yeah.
There's a lot of long hours, and there's a lot of time away on maneuvers at various points in the career. And you move a lot. So I think it's very much a function of the child and the family structure and whether families cope with it well or not. Some do, some don't. And I mean, it's the normal life that you'd like to think about is a life where the father has a nice, steady job, the mother doesn't have to work, the children live in the same neighborhood, in the same home, and there's four or five kids in the family, and the big brothers help. I mean, but very
where
few
is that? Right.
Kids grow up like that today.
Right.
Most of us grow up differently,
right.
And probably always have.
Yeah.
And so it was hard on my family, but I never thought it was impossibly hard.
Yeah.
We fought to try to make sure our son got a good education, and we fought to make sure we had a good house to live in, and we tried to help others get educations for their kids and have decent working environments and so forth. It was just part of the ongoing struggle inside a big organization to make sure the organization treats everybody well.
Mm-hmm. I know you have to leave us in a minute and 15 seconds, so I'll let you go, I promise, at 5-2. But let's go to Stan quickly from Denver, Colorado. Hi, Stan.
Hi, General. I was wondering if you experienced what I did as we began our military career about the same way. I got a delay of active duty, got promoted, and then my first day of active duty, I was a lieutenant junior grade instead of an ensign, and I experienced some resentment. To what extent did you did, sir?
Well, yeah, there's always a little bit of that. I mean, the armed forces is a big organization. You're wearing your rank on your sleeve or on your shoulder and your ribbons on your chest. And there's people who look at everything and measure themselves and compete. It's a competitive organization. I remember when I went into the basic course, I'd come out of Oxford. I was a captain. And I remember one of the officers or one of the wives maybe said, you know, you look as young as we are. I was 23, and they were 21 and 22, and some of them were 23, and said, and yet you're a captain, and my husband's only a second lieutenant. Why is that? And you just have to explain it, and once you explain it, then people get it.
Yeah. General Clark, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Wesley Clark, his book is A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. He has to go off and do a television show, so we find ourselves with a couple more minutes. I may just take one of your calls. The general is no longer with us, but I think we could just listen to your comments as well. His book has just been published by Macmillan, and he, of course, had a long, long career in the United States Army, 34 years. Was NATO's Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and is also the author of a couple other books, Waging Modern War and Winning Modern Wars. And his book covers his growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, his time at West Point, his time in Vietnam, his time in the Balkans, his time as an analyst for television after September 11, his thoughts about Iraq and why America has lost credibility in that part of the world and how to restore it, just a few things that are covered in his book, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. So we've got a couple minutes here. I just take a call. 800-486-8655. No general, but we could certainly listen to your comments before we go to the news. Bob from Verona, is it?
Viroqua.
Hi, Bob.
Hello. Thank you for the program. I was just thinking this morning as I was riding in the car that the job of commander-in-chief is so important that I thought perhaps it would be good if we changed our laws in this country to make sure that our commander-in-chief was at least a general or an ex-general and have it as a separate office in view of what our president has done.
Oh, that's interesting. It's too bad the general isn't here to combat on that. You'd have to change the Constitution, right, in order to do that?
That's a possibility. I'm not sure what you'd have to change, but it might be a good change.
Hmm.
So this wouldn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of who you would be thinking of to be a good commander-in-chief right now, who would that be, and who should be making the decision? You should be in an elective office?
Well, it could be, but I'm not sure how that would be implemented.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Bob, for your call.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Our number is 800-486-8655. We do have time for maybe one more phone call before we go to the news. The general had to leave us just a little bit early, so that's okay. You know, we can talk. I also like to give you, when I have a chance, our email address is here so that you can get in touch with us if you have suggestions for shows. We do those once a month open lines, but we can certainly, we like to hear from you at other times as well. So our number is our website, Fanning, Rhonda Fanning, the producer, Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G at WPR.org. Mine is Dunk, D-U-N-N-K at WPR.org. Gary from Eagle River, just a short call. Hi, Gary. Are you there, Gary? No, Gary's not. All right, everybody. Thanks so much for your calls. We thank General Clark for being with us. This program repeats at 10 o'clock in the evening. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but it's usually it's our 10 o'clock in the morning show that repeats at 10 o'clock in the evening. So in case you want to tell somebody to listen to the conversation with Wesley Clark, it will be on again this evening. Once again, his book, A Time to Lead for Duty, Honor, and Country. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee for all of your calls and for listening. I thank you as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn with you again tomorrow at 9 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.